Hello all, thank you for attending this session, and please welcome Alison Williams, creator of Apache Purik.
Yeah, so hi guys, thanks so much for coming to hear about Purik. We are a new incubating project, so we are looking for people to get involved. Before we get started, I'll introduce Tim Ellison here in the up towards the front. So he's a fellow, we're a PPMC because we're a podling, so he's on the PMC as well, as is Sunil, who'll probably walk in at some point. So this is what we're going to talk about. The goal is just to kind of introduce you to Purik, and if you have other questions or you want to go into the math behind it, I'm happy to talk to you about it at length because I'm a mathematician. So this is what we're going to cover. What is Purik? What's PIR? So PIR is what Purik does, which is private information retrieval, hence the name, PIRK. And then why Apache Purik? Why did we even put it out there? Some basics of Purik in terms of software and coding structure, and then a roadmap where we're going, how you can get involved, and then if we have time and interest, which we may not, but if you want to grab me afterwards, we can. So one of the first algorithms that we donated out into Apache Purik is called Wide Skies. And so there's a whole math deck. It's about 73 pages long that accompanies one of our white papers. Yeah, laughing. 73 pages long. It accompanies our white paper that's on the Purik website, and it'll kind of walk you through it. But I'm happy to take you through it as well. Okay, so what is Purik? So the goal of Purik, we are a frameable framework for scalable private information retrieval. So what is that? It's a really beautiful blend of mathematics and computer science. So private information retrieval is, you know, about a 20-year-old discipline. We'll talk about it a little more, but it allows you to really compute these pretty complicated types of equations at a large scale. It was developed at the National Security Agency. So a little bit of background for me. So I'm both a theoretical mathematician and a computer scientist. So PhD in math, algebraic combinatorics, set theoretic topology, and then did a master's in machine learning. So I'm one of those weird hybrid people. So spent a couple years at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab as a researcher, and then about 10 years at the National Security Agency as a researcher. And so this work that I did here and contributed out to Purik was when I was at a researcher at the National Security Agency, went through the process to open source it and donate the Wide Skies algorithms out into the open source community. So it was developed at NSA, which is where I'm from, donated the Apache Software Foundation in July 2016, so we are a brand new incubator project. That's why we'd love for you to get involved. Like I said, we're undergoing incubation. We've had two releases so far, so we're at 0.3 now. We're about to do another one here in, I don't know, a few weeks, and then we have a big refactor going on, some other interesting things that we'll talk about in the roadmap. Okay, so what is PIR? So private information retrieval. It is a theoretical field of mathematics and computer science up until this point. It's been around for about 20 years. So if you Google PIR, if you start looking at the papers, you're going to see a lot of technical papers that look like theorem proof, theorem proof, theorem proof. So a lot of really fun stuff, but no practical implementation. So if you look for code that's out there, there's some on GitHub, some prototypes that were done in some other places. Not really usable in a system perspective, definitely not usable at the kind of scale that we needed at the NSA. So we, what this allows you to do is retrieve information from a data set in a way that nobody can see what you're doing or the results that you're pulling back. So particularly with PIR, we focus on query. So it allows you to ask a question in a way that nobody can see what you're asking or the results that you're pulling back. So think about if you wanted to perform transactions in places that were untrusted environments and you didn't want the content of your question or the content of the result that you're pulling back to be seen, this technology allows you to do that. So it's powered by homomorphic encryption, which some people think is a little bit of math magic, but I promise you it's completely sound. It's a complete field. So you can read all of the, like I said, the theorem proofs about it. The big deal about homomorphic encryption is the operations that you do in cipherspace or on your encrypted data would be the same as if you had performed them on plain text space. So that's how we're able to kind of do some of this stuff. So without PIR, you know, you have all these people out there and they're asking questions and perhaps they're hitting the same data sets and maybe you practice good transport security. So from the point at which you ask the question to the point it hits the data, you know, you have it under SSL or TLS or whatever. But the minute that it hits that data, it's got to be decrypted and then operate over the data. That's when you're vulnerable. So you can see like this guy up here that has two questions. I mean, not only if I had access to the data can I see all of those questions from different people, but like for the guy that has multiple questions, you can start to see patterns in what they're interested in, which can not be a good thing. So with PIR, what happens is we encrypt the questions before they ever leave. And so all that you'll see if you were able to get into the data center with a bunch of encrypted questions, encrypted results that are coming out, you have no vulnerability there. All right, so here's the basic structure in PIR. So from a technical perspective, there are two parties in a PIR system. There's a querier and there's a responder. So the querier is the one that asks the data. So this guy has a question and he says, yeah, I'm going to use PIR. This is really awesome. So he encrypts his question and he sends it over to the responder who owns the data. So encrypt question, this is with homomorphic encryption. This just isn't any kind of, you know, AES or whatever else. This is a specific kind of homomorphic encryption. It has to be encrypted that way. You could also use SSL or TLS on top of that, but it's already encrypted with very strong crypto. It goes over to the data, and then without ever decrypting the question through the algorithms of PERC, it runs over your data set and it produces an encrypted answer. So it's not that it produces an answer and then the answer is encrypted. It's that through the algorithm, all the computations are completely encrypted end to end. There's never a point of decryption. So what spits out of there is an encrypted answer that then travels back to this guy. He decrypts it with the key that he used to encrypt his answer at the beginning, which is this is all in PERC, right? And then, of course, he thinks we're really awesome. So why PERC? So PIR, for the last 20 years, like I said, has been historically very largely theoretical, no practical way to use it. And there was really a need to kind of push it to the practical to get robust, kind of scalable implementations of PIR, which we didn't have at the moment. So we said, all right, let's see if we can do this. So, of course, inside of the agency, we had vested interest in being able to do this kind of private information retrieval. And then we thought, okay, we developed these algorithms. Let's put them out in Apache. Let's try to foster the community around the PIR and grow it that way. And that's what we did. So we wanted to have a landing place for the scalable, robust PIR. We wanted to specifically put it in Apache because of the community kind of atmosphere that Apache fosters and what Apache is all about. And hopefully we would grow it, grow the interest, and get it going from there. So the basics of PERC, this is what I talked about just a second ago. So there's a querier and a responder. So on the querier side, you're going to generate what we call an encrypted query vector. So there are ways to specify the questions that you want to ask in PERC. So PERC takes that, using this Wide Skies algorithm at the moment, because that's the one that we have in. It encrypts it, and it forms something called an encrypted query vector. That's homomorphic encryption. It gets sent over to the data, to the responder. So the responder's job is that it performs the encrypted query. So it takes those encrypted query vectors, it runs it over the data, performs the encrypted query, and then forms these encrypted query results, which that gets bounced back here. And then the querier can decrypt it with the keys that they had. And so there are a bunch of items that the querier generates on the querier side in order to decrypt the results as they come back. So this is what it looks like just from a pictorial perspective with PERC. So we have the querier, the responder, the information gets traded back and forth here. So beyond the querier and the responder, so we have an encryption library in PERC. So right now we're using PyA, the PyA crypto system, if you're familiar with that at all. So it's a type of homomorphic encryption. It's generally, we chose that for a couple of reasons. One, the implementation is nice for PyA, so it's provably equivalent to RSA. So we work with a lot of RSA moduli, which people are typically very comfortable with. So it's pretty well accepted in the community. So we weren't going to try to go out and do some kind of new homomorphic encryption that everybody would get a little concerned about. So this is PyA. It's standard. It's known. People use it when it's, you know, homomorphic encryption is involved, and it does use RSA moduli. The other really nice thing about RSA moduli is the security of an RSA modulus is very well understood. So, for example, for the U.S. government, there's a Suite B standard that tells you for different levels of security classification what kind of RSA level that you need. I can tell you for the kind of information that we would have to do from a classified perspective, it would be a 3072-bit modulus, which is very large. And then it goes down from there. So then you're going to go to 2048 and 124 and et cetera. So you can use any kind of modulus that you want in PERC. It's just a parameter. You put it in. So if you want to run really quickly and test it out, then go for a really, really small modulus. But don't, you know, kid yourself into believing that it provides you any security whatsoever. And then if you want to do it for production kind of scale deployments, you need to go up and figure out your trade space between how many years do I want it to take for someone to be able to break this, and that will give you what your modulus size would be. So just something to think about if you're using PERC and how to set your parameters with your RSA. So the data schema framework. So back on the responder side, when we had all of the data there, so PERC needs to understand the schema of the data. I'll show you that in just a second. It needs to understand what the data looks like. That schema can be very specific or it could be very generic. And it just depends on how much data you want to pump through PERC per query at a time. So the schema could be very generic in the sense of I have all of this data. It's a pile of, maybe it's a text document and it's a pile of sentences. Just go crunch it all. It'll take you a little bit longer than if you had a very structured schema to say, I'll show you some DNS examples, but for DNS, here's an IP address, here's a domain name, here's your R code, here's your Q type, all this stuff for DNS. So we do have a framework for specifying data schemas. The other thing that you need to specify when you work in PERC is a query schema. So what fields am I going to extract out of my data and place into my query? Like I said, that if your data schema is highly generic, then your resulting query schema can also be extremely generic too, or it can get very, very specific. It just depends on what you want to do with it. We do have a concept of a data filter in PERC. So the idea here is whatever data set that you want to run PERC over, you are revealing some information there. So you have to decide what your trade space is between the information that you're willing to kind of reveal about your question that you care about and what you want to hide. So for example, we were having this conversation yesterday. I may be completely okay saying, I want to run over all data from yesterday, and that doesn't reveal anything about my intention. So say maybe I have a month's worth of DNS data that's sitting in a big cluster, right? So I could say, I want to run these queries over everything that happened yesterday, and it doesn't reveal anything. To me, it doesn't matter. But I could go one step further from that and implement a data filter that says, maybe I want to filter out all of the Alexa top million out of my data set from yesterday before I run my query. So if you look at DNS data, it follows a power law distribution. So if I say cut out the Alexa top million, it's going to cut out the majority of stuff because I don't really care what people are doing with Google and Akamai and all the stuff that's in Facebook and the Alexa top million. So you can determine how much information you're willing to give up about your queries and how much you really want to protect under the crypto. And you can do that through your query schema and your data filter. And then test it, of course. We, big believers in testing, we have a lot of test code for obvious reasons. We have to make sure that when we put something in it, it actually works and we don't leak any information out and nothing's wrong. So I would say our testing is somewhere we spend a lot of time and we pay attention to. So we have pretty robust in-memory testing and then a distributed testing framework. We do the distributed testing on a cluster. We do not do it on a mock stand-up of Hadoop or Spark or Storm or whatever else, just because it's been my experience and some others that I've worked with that the behavior is not the same. So we don't want to test it that way. So we have a separate kind of testing suites there. The rule is never show XML on a slide, but I'm going to do it anyway because we're at ApacheCon. So this is an example of what our schema would look like with DNS data. And so this is a JSON representation of the DNS. So I have date, source IP, event type, query ID, queue type. This is just the type of record that it is. Destination IP, IPs, queue name, and R code. And so if I encode that over in my XML schema for my data, I need the name of the schema. I need for each specific element in my data, I need what it's called and I need the typing of it. So the reason I need the typing is because the way that the homomorphic encryption works is it's going to partition out and break up my specific element. So I have to have some idea about what it is so I can break it up and put it back together correctly. And that's specified in this partitioner and then if it's an array or not. So this is what the general data schema would look like. If I fill it in here, I can start with date. I think that's a string. It's not an array. And we have a primitive type partitioner built into the code. So anything that's a Java primitive, it will automatically partition for you if you just tell it that it's a primitive. And then you can implement any kind of custom partitioner. So this kind of data with the JSON, with DNS, you can see this is more string-based. You could maybe look at it as an integer, maybe an array. But imagine if you wanted to do a query over a graph, where each of your nodes were specific objects, then I may want to have a custom partitioner so that I understand that vertex object, that edge object, and know how to break it up. So PERC is extremely flexible in allowing you to do things like that. The other thing that's kind of being lost here that I'll point out since we're on data schema is we're looking at raw data at this point, what we're kind of considering raw data with JSON data, but PERC can take in any data. So you could even run private queries over analytic results. You could have analytics that run that then feed into PERC that you run things over that way. You can form kind of private question-focused data sets with PERC. So there's a lot of generic flexibility that's there. Okay, so query schema works similarly. This is our basic query schema representation. I would say that this is one of the areas that we could do a lot of optimization with. Like I said, we're a really, really new podling. So we're just starting with all these optimizations and things that we could do, but we had to pick a starting place. So for our query schema, we have the same type of DNS. Here, I've got to specify the data schema or data schemas that I would like for the query to run over. And then the elements that I'm going to return, these are the things that I want to see coming back to me. I'm going to specify that in the clear. So for the query schema, we're not encrypting that. So you will see, if I have DNS data, that what I want returned is maybe the queue name, the IP, whatever. If you really don't want anything leaked at all about what you care about, just return the whole thing. Just say, I want all fields. So for something that's maybe 15 fields or so, like a DNS record, it's not a big deal. If you have something that's like 500 fields, you may want to think twice about that, but that's up to you, right, and how you would want to do it. So for the elements of the query schema, you have that there. And then filter names, we have the concept of applying these processing filters that I described earlier about what I might want to do with the data to transform it before it's fed into my query. So you can specify these here, and then what what elements you want to apply to. So for example, you could say, I want a data filter applied to the queue name, and I want my filter to filter out all of the Alexa top million, the example that I just used. And so I'm going to automatically get rid of any records that have anything with Google, with Facebook, with Akamai, and leave that more interesting tail of the distribution of my data, because I know that's where the space is that I would care about, right? And then here, I'm defining it. So the elements that I would want to return here would be source IP and destination IP. This selector name that I didn't mention on the other website, this is really important. So you can have, right now in PERC, this query schema is coded to have a single selector per query. That's obviously something that could be changed on the line. You can have as much as you want, any combination of them or whatever. But right now I can say, I'm really going to select on a queue name. So when I form that encrypted query vector, I'm building in encryptions of everything I care about. So if I really cared about, mycooldomain.com and paper.org, I would encode that into my query vector, and I know that that's going to appear in a queue name. So when I design my query schema, I'm going to say I want queue names in my selector type, and then those are going to get pulled out, and then through some hashing and striping and encryption with WideSkies, it gets fed into a matrix, which then does the calculations for you. So you have to tell it some things. It's not, clairvoyant. You have to give it some information. And the information you have to give it here is which items and which fields are your selectors found. So our algorithms and implementation. So right now, for algorithms, we have WideSkies, which uses PyA. So if you go to, I might have it up here to give you a brief field trip. Okay, field trip over to our website. This is the Apache PERC website. There is a lot of information here if you poke around. So if you go up here to documentation and then papers and presentations, because we're so new, there's not tons and tons there, but the WideSkies paper is there. So I'll bring that up for just a second. So here is, if you flip through it, you'll see it is a math paper. But this will give you and explain to you everything about what's going on. And then if I can go back here. And then this is the deck that I was telling you about. So if you're really interested to see what's happening, so Walter is a friend and colleague of mine. We worked on this deck together. This will take that condensed paper that's just math, 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 and breaks it into slightly a more gentler treatment, right? And so if you look through it, you'll see actual words, which is a great thing, right? And then it tries to explain a little bit. It starts with, like, what is a group and what's a multiplicative group. So we're trying to make it accessible to people that aren't mathematicians. So if you read the deck armed with a good Wikipedia search, you should be able to make your way through to figure out what's going on. And so this is something that, like I said, I'm happy to walk through if we have time later and if we have interest. So that's WideSkies with PyA that's currently in there. That was donated by the National Security Agency when the work that I did there, we donated it out through Apache, like I explained before. So Querier, we have two ways to run the Querier. You can run it standalone with multi-threaded, or you can run it in a distributed way. So, or with the, go back here. with the responder, this is where a lot of the work really happens. So the querier, remember, you tell it what you're looking for, it encrypts your query vectors, and it's going to decrypt the results. But aside from that, it really doesn't do much else. The responder is where really where all the heavy lifting happens. So the responder runs over your data where that lives, and it's the one that takes that encrypted query and it runs it over to produce the encrypted result. So with WideSkies, there are a lot of matrix kind of computations going on, some partitioning, multiplications of large moduli. So we have standalone multi-threaded, so you can, you know, that's easy for testing. And then we've put it in a lot of different distributed platforms. So distributed batch so far, we've got MapReduce and Spark, and we can read data out of HDFS or Elasticsearch. So you could imagine that list could go on and on and on and on and on. You could read out of anywhere. You could write an adapter to read it out of wherever you might want to read it from. And then we could compute over all different kinds of computational platforms. These were just the first two. And then we also have it in streaming version. So I think the streaming is particularly cool because it is an example of how you could use the technology for watch listing things. So for private alerting. Right. If you think about all the applications, I haven't really gone into many of the applications of Perk, but if you think a little bit about what you could do in a streaming capacity from a private perspective, it gets really cool. So for distributed streaming, we have it in Storm, we have it in Spark Streaming, and then we are reading data out of Kafka. So we kind of tried to hit the kind of basic skeleton implementations on our first time around with batch and streaming. And then our roadmap, you know, where are we going? Like I said, brand new Podling, right? So for input adapters, you know, we can read from anywhere, and it's mainly as, you know, what the community cares about, what would be useful to people. So we could, of course, hook up to NoSQL databases. We could hook up to MySQL. We can, you know, integrate with HBase, with Accumulo. We're already working with Kafka through Storm, but we could really up, you know, our read from Kafka. We could read from NiFi. NiFi, another NSA project. Accumulo, another NSA project, right, keeping that all in the family. But we could read from almost anywhere. From a streaming capacity, there's been a lot of talk about Flink, so we've talked quite a bit about, you know, integrating with Flink, so we could do that. For Storm and now Heron, so we did Storm first. We wanted to really get it on Heron, but it wasn't quite out yet when we were doing it. So Heron would be a natural place to move next for a streaming distribution. And then we're already in Spark Streaming, but there's a lot of optimization and work that can be done there. So I would say that even with the implementations that we already have with Spark and MapReduce and Spark Streaming, that there's quite a bit that can still be done. So our algorithmic roadmap. So if you haven't noticed, there are two kind of vectors of Perk. So one is the math and trying to push the math forward, and the other is the comp sci, and then people that are going to translate between them, right? So from a mathematical perspective and an algorithmic roadmap, so this is one of the projects that has a algorithmic roadmap, we want to see secure multi-party communication. This is private set intersection. That's if you have a set of things and I have a set of things, can we securely figure out if we have an intersection without revealing anything else? It's a really cool problem. It is a field. There's a lot of theoretical basis to it. And there are some algorithms that are already out there that I think with a little bit of tweaking, we could stick in Perk and it would be really nice. So, and then fully homomorphic encryption. So what we have right now is called partially homomorphic encryption. So we have multiplicative operations in cipher space that translate into additive operations in plain text space. So with fully homomorphic encryption, you get both multiplicative and additive operations in cipher space. Fully homomorphic encryption is highly computationally intensive. So a lot of what we're able to do with Perk is, you know, we developed the algorithms that were essentially linearly parallelizable. So that's nice because we could throw a bunch of machines at it and we can go as fast as, you know, you're willing to throw compute, right? Fully homomorphic encryption just is a lot slower. So eventually we may get there if we start algorithmically working on that, but there are a lot of people beating on the door of that right now. So what's always on the roadmap for us are improvements and optimizations to our existing code base. So there's tons of stuff that we can do. Benchmarking. So we need to do some benchmarking within the Perk project to make available on the Perk website. So we need to do quite a bit of benchmarking there and make that available to the community so they can really see what's happening. And then just talking to Tim this morning, well, we're undergoing a big refactor at this point, trying to make it a little bit more friendly to deploy your querier and responder. Right now we're in a flat POM. So we're breaking that out into modules, which we just didn't do before we stuck it in. So breaking that out into modules to allow you to kind of deploy out to the responder and deploy out to a courier without sending everything. And then Tim is working on, if you want to say anything about that, the REST calls.
Yeah, just for the exchange information, you start the other really query and respond to the rest of the calls at the very end.
Yeah, so right now it's mainly an algorithmic tool. And so if you're a developer, you'll find your way around and it'll be awesome. And if you're a general user, you're going to be kind of sad. So we have some work to do in order to make it friendly to a general user base. And part of that will be adding the REST interface and how do I get these objects back and forth? How do I kind of query N without knowing too much about what's going on under the hood? So that's where we are there. And we would love people to get involved. So like I said, we're really new. We like mathematicians and computer scientists. So if you're, I don't know if anybody's a mathematician in the audience, but if you are, even if you wanted to algorithmically collaborate on the code base and, on the mailing list and send emails and all that kind of stuff, that's great. We would welcome you into the community and you would never have to write a line of code. And then if you're a computer scientist and you want to contribute, that's fantastic. We have tons and tons and tons of implementation to do and optimizations to do that don't have anything to do with the math, and you can really code around the math without having to understand it. And then we've had some folks that, maybe are computer scientists but really want to understand the math. So we try hard on the mailing list through lots of emails, which would be a lot easier on a whiteboard, right? But through emails, we really try to kind of bring people up to speed and explain what's going on and what's happening so that they feel like they can contribute in a meaningful way and perhaps see ways to optimize the computation that maybe you wouldn't see if you didn't really understand what was going on with the math. So we love all people, right? Like I said, you don't have to code. This is our website. These are our mailing lists for dev and commits. Dev gets responded to very quickly. So if you send something to dev, one of us will pick it up and respond back. And of course, we tweet a little bit, so you can follow us on Apache Perk. And that is the general portion of the talk. So I am happy to, we'll take questions first about the general stuff. I'm happy to go back and talk about anything that we already covered from a general perspective. And if folks are interested, I'll go into the math, or I can go deeper on anything else that we talked about. Any questions so far? Okay, I didn't want to scare people away, so I wanted to give you a choice. Any other general questions about the framework or Perk or why we put it out there, where we're going? Yeah.
If I understand, for example, you have the responder server on some node on your cluster, and it reads a data set, and in the future you will read it from Edgebase, etc., for your implementation, but does it support authentication towards its components, these components? I mean, when you need to authenticate to be able to read the data, does it support or will the support be enabled in the future?
That's a really great question. We've had quite a bit of debate about that on the list. So the idea of Perk is that it would be an application running in an end user system, not a system in and of itself. So as an application running in an end-user system, we're expecting whoever is using it to integrate it with their current access control and authentication mechanisms. Otherwise, Perk is going to become, like I said, an entire system in and of itself that would provide authentication and access control and a bunch of stuff that's really not core to the mission of what Perk is trying to do, which is foster the scalable PIR. So the answer is Perk doesn't do that explicitly, but Perk will support it because as an application, you just allow it to see whatever you would like for it to see, even on a per user, per query basis.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
So if I want to integrate Perk into my search system, and then it will allow my users to ask questions encrypted, so that I don't know what they ask, but they can still get answers.
Right.
And you said that the user picks his or her encryption key.
Yeah.
How does that then translate to how the data is indexed or stored on the responder backend system?
Yeah. So as long as you, so with the querier, you're going to have it generate a key. So right now, through PyA, there's a PyA module in Perk, which you can take a look at and look, but we have them specify some parameters about what kind of key you want, the modulus size and you can get really specific about even other things that you would want to specify, and then we generate it for them. Perk generates it for them. And the reason being is there's a lot of user error in copy-pasting keys and entering primes and things like that, and those user errors defeat the point of our system, which means it weakens it, right? So if you make a mistake in entering your key, then we can break it, which you don't want to do. And it might not even be an RSA modulus at the end of the day, right? So you have to be really careful. So we generate that right now. And then, so that's held in the querier. But the querier doesn't know anything about the responder implementation other than the data set, you know, the data schema and the query schema that it would need to be running over. So from a responder perspective, as long as you specify your data schema and your query schema in order to define what your data looks like and define what query you want to run on it, then it can be in any format that you would like for it to be in.
Okay, and the second question is, you said that also the reason to encrypt the query is so that on the backend, if someone would eavesdrop maybe on the server, he would know the patterns that users search for. I'm no encryption expert, but if you just encrypt keywords or something, then the encryption of the word, I don't know, that looks the same all the time, so people can draw statistics and then figure out that these encryption patterns happen more often than others, and maybe it's an English user base, so it's more likely that this is the word there, and maybe use it in a way to decrypt back the messages?
No, it's a really great question. So there are two different kinds of encryption. Well, there are lots of kinds of encryption, but I'll talk about two categories for a second. One is deterministic encryption, which means every time I encrypt something, I get the same ciphertext out again. That's what you're talking about, and that's where I can perform frequency analysis, where I can't necessarily see what's under the hood, but I can see the distribution of your data if it's deterministically encrypted, right? And that common wisdom is don't do that, right? So what we're doing is not deterministic, it's called semantic. So semantic encryption, it has the property that if I encrypt the same two things, that they never go to the same plain text value, I mean the same ciphertext value. So I can't perform that frequency analysis. So PyA is a form of semantic encryption. So when I throw those queries over to the other side, even if it's exactly the same query, I can't tell that that would be the case. So that's one of the powerful things about the PyA encryption that we use inside of Perk, is you cannot perform that kind of frequency analysis.
Can I follow on with another question?
Sure.
So I just come from the Apache Lucene Solo project, and so I think about inverted indexes, and eventually there are terms, index terms underneath.
Yep.
So if two users ask the same query and it gets translated to two different ciphertexts, what's stored in the index eventually? What's the type of information in there?
So we're not, right now with Perk, you're going to produce a result and you send it back. That doesn't necessarily get written back to the data source where it came from. You could tell it to write it back, but not necessarily. If you wanted to write it back, it would look like an encrypted blob of nothing, right? Just a bunch of bits. And it's semantically encrypted, so I wouldn't be able to tell. I will say that one of the first implementations, and I'm not sure if I put it on the slide, I might have put the icon on the slide. One of the inputs that we read from is Elasticsearch, which is very similar. So we read from Elasticsearch, and in that case, we're using the ESHadoop input format, so we can specify the different query strings that would go into that, and it goes out and it sends our workers to, you know, the nodes where the shards live. And in that case, we're just reading the data out. We read it out. We process it the same way that we process any other data, and then it gets sent back. So if you wanted to write it back in, you can choose where you would want to do it, but that would be a piece of code that you would glue onto Perk. So Perk would give you a result, and then if you wanted to throw it in an index somewhere, you could do that. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. Any other general questions about Perk? Let's see how we're doing on time. Good? Okay. So anybody that doesn't want to see any math, I would suggest you just leave now. It's all right. Thank you for coming and hearing about Perk, and shoot me an email on the mailing list. Otherwise, I'll flip over to the wide skies. Let's see if I have it somewhere where we can take a look. Can you see that, or would you like me to download it? I wasn't expecting, honestly, that anybody would care one iota about seeing the math, but I'm thrilled that you do. So this is really long. You can go over it yourself. I'm going to skip through it and kind of just give you a narrative of what's here. and then you can read it in detail later on. So like I said, Walter is another committer on Perk and a friend of mine, and we worked on the deck. So this should give you just a little bit idea about WideSkies. So WideSkies is the particular algorithm that we donated into kind of seed Perk. We're hoping that more algorithms will follow from the community into Perk for PIR. So we've already talked about this, so that the way Perk kind of works with breaking down into a querier and responder and the fact that we use PyA. And then this was all the language of this group notation. I won't go through explaining what a group is, but if you want to read about what a group is, if you're not familiar with it, as Tim's laughing at me, yes, it is here. You can go through it if you'd like. What I really want to get to is more of the algorithmic boxes that say this is what we're doing in the algorithm and this is how it's working. And there are a couple of examples at the end, but I'll have to flip through quite a bit of slides to get there. So for PyA encryption, and this is what it looks like. This is the functionality that's going to go into it. So it goes from the additive group of Zn, and it takes an element from the additive group of Zn in the multiplicative group of Zn, and it sends it into the multiplicative group of Zn squared. So n is going to be your RSA moduli. So think about if you had a 124-bit modulus, then the order of your group over here for Zn squared is going to be 2048. So it's twice because of just the properties there that we're working with. So just think about when you take something and you encrypt it, you're ending up going into a space that's twice the bit size of where you started. So when you're doing these computations, you got to think about with your modulus trade-off, you know, how big do you want your modulus to be as to how big of numbers do you want to be working with on your encrypted side. And then these are some of the PyA, you know, specifics that I won't go through. This is explaining what the difference is between fully homomorphic encryption and partially homomorphic encryption. It turns out that there's not a good mathematical agreed upon definition. So if you Google it, you're going to find people to talk about it a lot of different ways. So we decided to explain it in a way that, you know, as you can see, it's squishy and not very mathematical. But the easiest way to do it is for partially homomorphic, you have one operation in cipher space. For fully homomorphic, you have two. So if you have multiplicative operations in cipher space that translate into additive operations in plaintext space, then you have to think in terms of what types of building blocks can I make out of multiplicative operations? And remember, those multiplicative operations are very large moduli sizes. So this is the PyA, the basics for PyA. This is just the encryption and decryption. So you can see that when I multiply two elements, so that E denotes encryption. So when I multiply two elements encrypted elements here in my cipher space and take that mod n squared, because remember, I'm in the multiplicative group of order n squared, and I decrypt that, it's the same thing as if I had added them together mod n. So that's the partially homomorphic property that you have. The other really nice part here is if you derive it all down, is if I take an exponent of an encrypted element in my cipher space, it's the same thing as if I had multiplied that exponent by the original element in my plain text space. We completely exploit that all day long in WideSkies. It's one of the key things that makes our algorithm work. So, and you can derive them all if you wanted to. So this is more general PyA. You don't need to see that. This is the kind of official general description of what PyA is. And so you could go through and, you know, look at these random values. You asked a question about semantic versus deterministic encryption earlier. That random value that you choose out of that group is what gives you the semantic encryption. So mathematically, you get semantic encryption here. Just as an FYI, if you're going through the slides and you're saying, why in the world is this not deterministic? It's because of that random value that you pull out. So, and then that's the encryption and the decryption. You can verify that these properties are true and they're, important things to take a look at. And this is PyA as we use it in WideSkies. So we use a derivation. It turns out it's exactly mathematically equivalent to the original PyA, but it's a simplification for our computations. So we just, use one of our elements. This is G element, which you have to go into if you're interested. And then the original PyA simplifies to this a little bit, so it looks a little bit simpler. If you're looking at just Greek letters floating around, there are a little fewer of them right here than there were before. And then, of course, the original PyA paper, you can take a look at that. It's a math paper, so, it'll take you some time to walk through it, but it's really beautiful, the math. And it's also linked on our website. So we thought it was so cool we linked it on the website so you can take a look at it. So wide skies. So these are all the parameters that you're going to specify for wide skies and hints for PERC right now. So if you want to run PERC, you're going to have these parameters that you need to specify. So your modulus, which we're going to kind of generate for you, the bit size of your modulus is there. You need a keyed hash function. You're going to give us the key. Right now we're generating the key. We just overhauled the way that we did the keying for the hash function. The bit length of your hash space, so that becomes very important. So right now in PERC, I usually default to using a 20-bit hash. So a 20-bit hash means I have 2 to the 20th many entries. So when you look at your matrix, which I'll get to in a second, so the way Wide Skies works is it takes your data and it stripes it through a matrix, and then it does some encryption and some nice operations. So the number of rows in your matrix is equal to your hash space. So if I pick, it's 2 to the L. So if I pick a 20-bit hash, that means I'm going to have 2 to the 20 many rows in my matrix, which is about 1 million. So it's not unreasonable, right, to work with. Then the number of search terms, that's the number of selectors that we talked about a little bit earlier. So how many things do you want to encode? There is a bound on the number of search terms that you can put in one set of query vectors, and that's going to be determined by the partition size that's down here, this B, this chunk size of how we're going to stripe out the data and chunk it out, divided by your modulus size. And that's because I'm going to stripe data down my matrix, and if every single one of my data elements that I put in my matrix is all ones, and I have that B and divided by N, if I go more than that, I'm going to overflow my modulus and I'm going to lose my data. So you have to be really careful about these parameters. So this is why when you want to use PERC, it's best that, you know, you talk to somebody that knows something about the math so you understand what's going on, just so that you know how to set these properly. We will give some defaults and some guidance, and if you shoot us a note on the mailing list, we're happy to kind of help you out. If you say, hey, I'm trying to do this, how would I parameterize it not to be, you know, to kick myself in the head with what I'm doing, like losing data and being insecure or whatever, and we're happy to help you out, so just reach out. And so then, you know, you can see the rest of this. The parameters are, this is the number of responses that can be returned per query, per request. You don't have to set that. I mean, it can be, as many as can you could fit. You could set that to be a ridiculously large number, and so you wouldn't lose any of your data. But you have to think about when you're performing all these computations, the number of responses that you're going to perform are going to equal to the number of columns in your matrix, as you'll see with Wide Skies as it goes through. And so if you don't limit that, if you already know that the thing that I would care about in my data would only occur maybe 500 times a day, then you shouldn't return 5,000 unless you have a really good obfuscation reason for doing so, because it costs you a lot more time and computation. So you want to be careful about how you set that. And of course, I'm going way more down in the weeds than, a general PERC talk. But these are the kinds of things we're happy to answer on the list. And then these are some more of the relationships to the parameters. So because they're mathematical parameters, you do have to obey the certain relationships. We have checks in the code that will throw it back to you if you've done something that's obviously wrong. So the code will let you do dumb things, parameterize it in a way that wouldn't be secure, or you would perhaps lose things. But anytime you're going to go really down the wrong road, the code says, hey, stop, you know, and it's going to kick it back to you and say your parameters you've specified are not reasonable. And so these are all, you know, more information. And of course, us being mathematicians, we have a tendency to give you way too much information, right, in the paper and on the website and whatever, because we believe that kind of giving you too much is better than not giving you enough and letting you trip over yourself, right, and make bad choices. So these are more parameterization. So we do have several slides on parameters and pitfalls with them, how to choose them. This is without encryption. I'm not going to go through the without encryption just for the sake of time, but what we tried to do without encryption is to say, if I wasn't working in cipher space, what would these operations look like? And it's far more intuitive, because what we're doing is really encoding bit masks, and then we're doing modular exponentiation. And then remember I said that when we do that modular exponentiation in cipher space, if I convert that back to plain text space, it's like I took that exponent and brought it down here to multiply. So the trick is, we've encoded all these kind of bit vectors that act as a Kronecker delta, if you're familiar with that. So 0 or 1, so it'll take it or it'll leave it. And so when you encrypt it, you have the exponent. When you decrypt it, it brings it down to the front, and you can see what I'm throwing away and what I'm keeping. And so it's a little bit easier to see those operations if you're working in plain text space. I mean, wide skies in plain text is not the algorithm. It just gives you an idea of what's going on. I'll see here. So here's the query without any encryption. And like I said, I'm going to skip over this a little bit. And the response and how we're doing bit shifting with it. This is the streaming version. So there's a streaming version. There's a batch version. The original algorithm was a streaming version because anything I have streaming, I can easily convert to batch. It's harder to go the other way around. So we made it streaming, and then we back it back into batch. This is without encryption. You can see this is the kind of matrix I'm talking about. These are your indexes down your hash, but I'm going to skip through to the encrypted part. But you can see the data is kind of being striped in, but it's doing it without encryption. So you would never do this. Okay, so here we are with encrypted data. This is what's happening for our query formation in our ciphertext space. So I have a random key for my hash. This is my keyed hash that I described earlier. And I have these selectors. So this T0 to T tau minus 1 are selectors that I have, things that I want to encode in. So this could be Facebook. We don't want to use Facebook. Paper.org, mycoolwebsite.com, whatever you want, right? So you want to encode that in, and you want to hash it. So I need all of those hashes to be unique because that's giving me my position of my row in my matrix. So I need to make sure. So all this is saying is make my hashes unique. That's it with the keyed hashes. And keep going. So if I get a hash collision, then what's going to happen is that it's going to start over and pick a new key. So it's going to keep picking a new key until I have a distinct hash space for my selectors. And then I'm forming these encrypted query vectors. So what's happening here is I set it to be 2 to the j times b. So this is just a set of bits, right, in these j times b positions. If for my selector j, it goes to I. So my ith one, which will correspond to my ith row in my matrix, is the encryption of 2 to the jb. And j was the positioning of my selector there. And b is my partition size that I'm trying to bring back. So I take my b chunks of data, and I do that modular exponentiation in my algorithm. It's going to bring it to the front. And when I decrypt it, it looks like I had my data times 2 to the JB. And then I can shift that over, and I can get exactly what it is back again and reconstruct my data. I just got the 5 minute, so I'm speeding it up just a little bit. And zero otherwise. So this kind of gives you that Kronecker delta view that I talked about a little bit earlier. And that's your query vector. That's how you form your query vector. So we never encrypt the actual selector and send it across. We encrypt a bit masking of how to find your selector when you hash it through your matrix on the other side. So that's what you're sending over. So your responder, let's see, this is the stream processing version. It's a little bit easier to see. So if I have my selectors here, the first thing, I'm computing the hash of the selector. This counter right here, all it's doing is counting the columns of my matrix. So I have a matrix that has the number of rows equals to my hash space. The number of columns is how many data elements times the chunk size that I'm returning, times how many partitions per data element, if I get really specific about it. So I split my data into these D chunks. So if it's 8 bits, it's bytes. So I'm just splitting it into bytes. And then I'm doing this modular exponentiation. So I take so I took the hash of my selector to find my row. And each row corresponds with an encrypted part of my query vector. I take this data, I raise it and do the modular exponentiation in cipher space, mod n squared. And that gives me a column value. And so here, what's happening is, if in your batch case, you take and you fill your whole matrix out, your rows and your columns, and at the very end, you multiply down your columns, and that compresses the data. That's one of the tricks for bandwidth. We compress it all down, and we just return one value per number of columns that you had in your matrix. And so this, in the streaming case, right, I'm not maintaining all of that. I'm just doing it as I go along, right? So I compute this, and I do the multiplication, and then I increment my counter, and at the very end, when I've gotten all my data in, I know I'm skipping over a lot and talking quickly, then I output the set of columns that I had in my matrix. And then what I can do is decrypt it. So it looks like we just skipped right to an example. But this is what it looks like here. So when this is an example of what it would look like in the batch case where I have my data and it's striping in with the modular exponentiations as I'm decrypting them. And then this would be the matrix variant of it. I was trying to see if there was. So this goes through an actual example. I think we have like 1 minute. So for the decryption, when I do the decryption, it gives you that bit vector raised to that value, like I said. It's going to bring it down to the front. I shift it over, and then I get my actual data element back again, and I can reconstruct it. So the mathematical proofs of why that's secure and why it's unbreakable are all in the paper. They're throughout PyA. and different things, but it's kind of some sleights of hand that we play. So I think I have like 30 seconds, so any other questions? Thanks for hanging out with me through some math. That was really cool. And happy to answer anything else. So if you have any other questions about the math, please come find me. If you go think about it later and say, this is really cool, but I have no idea how to get started, please shoot me an email on the mailing list. Happy to help you out. Okay, thanks for coming. Yeah.